Are you aware of the FAA's new regulations on taxiing? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot. Today we're going to append and the Journal for the Well-Informed Pilot, because there may be something happening in a couple of days here that you didn't know about that may affect the way you fly. And more than that, even if it doesn't legally affect the way you fly, you may want to take it as an example for things you do voluntarily. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
As always, Paul, I enjoy being with you.
Bob, in the June edition of Over the Airwaves, you talk about something that is about to take effect, and it is going to change the way we taxi at controlled airports. Explain what that is.
Well, you know, all of us know that under FAR 129I, for sake of giving a source to this, we are authorized to taxi to or cross any and all runways en route to the runway for which we've been cleared to take off, except we cannot cross an active runway. In other words, if we've been cleared to depart runway or taxi to runway 23, we could cross runway 18 or whatever en route to get there. That rule is changed, or in fact has been eliminated effective June 30th of this year by an amendment, an FAA amendment to the Air Traffic Controller's Handbook, FAA Order 7110.65, that removes that authority to do that. And I'm reading now an explanation right from the policy change. It says, this change establishes the requirement that an explicit runway crossing clearance be issued for each runway en route to the departure runway. In other words, there's no more crossing automatically all runways without a clearance. We have to receive a clearance to cross every runway on the airport.
Okay, now how exactly will this work? Do you anticipate that if we're at a big enough airport for this to be a factor, they will change the phraseology? Because what's at issue here is the phrase taxi to. So if they're telling you to taxi to your departure runway and you have to cross other runways, will they still say taxi to and expect you to know to stop?
Well, that's an unknown. Now, the requirement, also a recent change, is when issuing taxi instructions, air traffic controllers have got to give deliberate, specific instructions on how they want you to get where they want you to go. And now I suspect they're going to be issuing hold short instructions in front of the next runway along the way. For example, taxi runway 29, hold short of 19. And so they'll be issuing these hold shorts at each point along the way. Now, if they do that, then there's no problem. We pilots comply with what ATC control, with air traffic controllers are telling us. But if a controller slips and says simply taxi runway 24 or whatever, and we cross an active runway without a clearance, then we're going to be culpable. The problem that we have right now, this rule becomes effective in just the next couple of days. How many of us out there have been notified of this? I haven't seen it other than through a chat forum that I participate in on ABSIG, Aviation Special Interest Group. Now, no doubt there will be some guidance issued here, but I think the onus in this case is on the part of the controller to be sure that he's not authorizing individuals to cross all runways without giving, you know, the necessary hold short instruction.
Well, and to be clear, too, this is not just about active runways. This is active, inactive, or closed.
That's right. All runways. No longer are we able to cross a runway, open or closed, active or inactive, on an airport surface at a tower-controlled airport without a specific clearance, effective June 30th, 2010.
Well, it's going to be interesting. It'll probably catch a few people, and it'll be interesting listening to the radio for a couple of days after this hits.
But I think it's a good rule. I think it's long overdue, and I just want to say parenthetically that this is also a good rule for us to follow at non-towered airports as well, rather than just taxiing through inactive runways. We should stop at all runways. Stop at every single runway, open or closed, look left, right, before proceeding across it. It just makes good sense. It's like coming to a four-way stop in our automobile. It just takes a second to do, and then continue on.
Well, and it wouldn't hurt to pick up the microphone too, and make mention of that on the CTAF, especially if you think you're alone at the airport, because the guy coming in on final might think he's alone at the airport as well.
That's right.
I have heard accidents, or close calls where the pilots, a pilot would say, "Well, I didn't hear anything going on at the airport, so I didn't bother making a radio call." Well, Hello. If everybody thinks that way, nobody would go first.
That's right. Far too many runway accidents are happening on airport surfaces. And the FAA, they're the ones that have been shouting the loudest on cutting back on runway incursions, taxiway incursions, and yet they had this foolish rule on the book for decades. And I think so much of what we see accident-wise can be corrected if we get around to fixing a lot of these antiquated, out-of-date rules that are still being carried on the books. This is one good example of that, and there are countless others in the far aim. We don't have time to go into each and every one of them there, but that book is, in many cases, just far out of date, and it requires careful, continuous study to keep it up to date. And if it were up to date and properly evaluated and corrected, we can eliminate a lot of accidents and incidents right there.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, I want to change the subject kind of dramatically and talk about an Avemco Insurance Company study that is very encouraging to me, and I think you seem to have found encouragement in it too. Bob Miller is my guest. Back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And Bob, in the June issue of Over the Airwaves, you talked about something that's been kind of on my mind for a while, and that is the role that insurance companies might play as a market force in promoting safety in areas where regulators apparently fear to tread. And specifically what I've been thinking about, and we've talked about a couple of times in the past, is that it's my contention that if insurance companies were able to quantify these risks to their own satisfaction that we see in general aviation, and these are some of the risks that other people would propose that regulation resolve, it's hard to get a regulation passed. But for an insurance company to say, we've determined that such and such is a risk factor in aviation accidents, therefore we're going to offer a discount to you if you take this course or complete this kind of instruction or fly this sort of aircraft. In other words, the same kind of thing they do if you're a safe driver. If you satisfy their requirements to get insurance, eventually, this is going to become a market force where doing the right thing will be an economic benefit to pilots.
Well, Paul, that's absolutely right, and there's no question what you said is true. I see it from a slightly different perspective, in the fact that if we could change or alter our instructional approach to address factors that are being discovered as causal in most of the accidents today, we could, in effect, reduce the accidents by just changing how we're instructing. First of all, we have to operate from the premise that our fatal accident rate is no better today than it was 10 years ago. In fact, the most recent year that we have data compiled by the Air Safety Foundation shows that for the first time, our accident rate is worse than the year before. So we have a problem. In fact, the quote that I used in the lead in this article by Mac McClellan over at Flying Magazine, he said, and I quote, "The fact that general aviation kills 500 or more people in a typical year is crazy, and even more so because nothing in that sorry record has changed over the years." This is a very serious problem, and, you know, without indicting our friends over at some of the Alphabet organizations at in general aviation, who, in my opinion, are, you know, they're just putting the accents on the wrong syllable safety-wise, VEMCO is coming up with accident data that is dispelling a lot of myths in the safety record. For example, their data shows that the accident rate does not correlate with total hours. You know, once we get beyond 200 hours total PIC time, we have as many 10,000-hour pilots in fatal wrecks as we do 500-hour, 200-hour pilots, number one. Number two, fatal accident rates do not correlate with the number of ratings and certificates that we have. We have as many instrument and commercial and ATP pilots, rated pilots, in fatal accidents as we do with private pilots. And number three, they're discovering that it's not the maneuvering or skills-based training that's causing the problem, or skills that we have, stick and rudder skills. The real problem is judgment skills, aeronautical decision-making skills. So all of this tells us that we need to be changing the paradigm. We need to be changing how we're instructing our students, spending less time on skills-based maneuvers training and more time in aeronautical decision-making. And they go through in this FEMCO study, and I summarize some of it in the current issue of Over the Airways, trying to identify which kind of pilot characteristics, what kind of pilot behavior is predictive of who will and who will not suffer an accident.
The other thing, Bob, that really strikes me about this is we talked a couple of months ago on the topic of knowing how many accidents are caused by mechanical issues versus how many are caused by pilot error. Why are we spending so much time pre-flighting the hardware and so little time pre-flighting mm-hmm. the pilot? I guess the thing I wonder, too, is when we go into a primary flight school or a flight school for primary instruction, we know the human factors material has been in the private pilot syllabus for a long time now. Why is there not some organized method for determining whether people coming in the door are subject to any of these particular hazardous attitudes? There ought to be almost be some kind of psychological test that lets instructors craft the course to help mitigate those tendencies.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure we can do that, and I'm not sure we as flight instructors could even interpret that kind of test results. But I know what we could do as flight instructors, and that is assess how a pilot acts on a real training flight that takes them out of the practice area and over, you know, over some distance between two or three different airports. For example, let's say we travel 50 miles and grab a hamburger for lunch and travel back, and then the weather directly ahead of us is looking ominous. And the student says, well, you know, I got to be back. I've got this important dinner engagement with my wife. I promised her I'd be back at 5 o'clock, and it's now 4 o'clock, but the weather ahead is looking threatening. And then just sitting back as a flight instructor and say, all right, you work the problem now, son. You tell me what you want to do here. And, they say, well, I got you along, Bob, and you're not going to let me do anything foolhardy. I said, no, I'm not here. You're going to make up your mind. And then, man, if they divert or go back to where we had lunch where the weather is good, that's a very, very good sign as far as I'm concerned. If, on the other hand, they act a little too boldly and say, no, I think we can get around it this way, or I think we can sneak under it this way, and then I say, well, what's your back door if it closes out? Closes in around us. And if they come back and say, well, you're on board, Bob, and you have an instrument ready, you get us out of it, I said, that's not an acceptable back door as far as this training flight is concerned. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we can do both in the air, and here's where we can use some simulator training as well. This is a good use of a simulator where we can get in and set up these scenarios. Not necessarily failed systems, you know, what to do if we have an oil pressure light come on. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about aeronautical decision-making related to weather, related to low fuel issues, related to unexpected headwinds. These are things that we can begin to assess and then include in every training exercise that we go out with a student, rather than just going out in the practice area and doing steep turns and slow flight and stalls. I mean, we have to do those maneuvers, but they can be incorporated as part of our scenario-based training to different airports.
Well, and let's hope that the idea of scenario-based training, if only for that reason, spreads even further than it has already. It looks like it's moving through the industry. Bob, we appreciate your thoughts on this and always appreciate talking to you. We'll catch you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can always find the current issue of Bob Miller's newsletter at overtheairwaves.com. While you're there, put yourself on a list to receive an email reminder each time a new one is published. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.